You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. On June 2013, President Barack Obama nominated James Comey to the position of Director of the FBI, succeeding Robert Mueller. Mr. Comey's 10-year appointment was confirmed the following month by a 93-1 vote in the Senate. As a career prosecutor, James Comey helped dismantle the Gambino crime family, and in his new book, the number one selling book in the country, A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership, he returns often to what he refers to as the, quote, toxic consequences of lying and the corrosive effects of choosing loyalty to an individual over truth and rule of law. James Comey's first career choice was to be a doctor, and he was a pre-med student at the College of William and Mary. He then added religion as a second major, studying the life and work of philosopher and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who wrote about how one seeks a measure of justice in an imperfect world. And ultimately, a career in law was James Comey's decision on the best way to make a difference in society. Mr. Comey has served under three U.S. presidents. His reputation as a defender of the Constitution was indelibly shaped by his decision one night in 2004 to rush to the hospital room of his boss, Attorney General John D. Ashcroft, to prevent Bush White House officials from persuading the ailing Ashcroft to reauthorize a national security surveillance program that members of the DOJ believed violated the law. He was dismissed from his term as FBI. Yeah, you may give him a round of applause for that. It's pretty cool. He was dismissed from his term as FBI director by the current U.S. president on May 9th, 2017, just over a year ago from tonight. He kept notes. He wrote a book. You're here tonight to hear the man himself. James Comey has been at the center of what, in his own words, he calls, quote, one of the craziest, most consequential, and even educational periods of his, and some might say, the country's life, unquote. He is inarguably a towering figure of our era who has been and is still at the tipping point of history. As our interlocutor tonight to discuss with James Comey about his book and about that tipping point and much else is veteran journalist Jim Newton. We're very happy Jim is here to interview James Comey tonight. Jim was at the Los Angeles Times for 25 years, working as a reporter, editor, bureau chief, columnist, and from 2007 to 2010, editor of the editorial pages. And he currently serves as the editor-in-chief of Blueprint, a UCLA magazine addressing policy challenges facing California and Los Angeles. He is himself the author of three books, co-author of former CIA director Leon Panetta's memoir, and the author of two highly regarded biographies of Chief Justice Earl Warren and President Dwight Eisenhower. I want to thank all of you, first of all, for coming tonight, but also those of you who submitted questions on cards. Jim will get to some of those tonight. Please join me in welcoming James Comey and Jim Newton to the stage of the Aretani Theater.
Well, welcome. I'm glad you all could join us for this important, exciting evening. It's nice to see so many friends in the audience. Mr. Comey, welcome to L.A. The last time James Comey was in L.A., President Trump fired him over the television. I trust your trip is going better this time.
Yeah.
So far.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. I listened to Director Comey talk to a group of students before, and you did emphasize the importance of laughter, so yep. Here we go. So here's how we're going to do this tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about Mr. Comey's book, a little bit about the incredible situation facing our country, and then I have, from courtesy of all of you who filled out these cards outside, a bunch of questions from all of you, more than we will get to tonight, but which I'll try to intersperse as we go.
Great.
All right, so to start, one of the things that really impressed me about your book and about the appearances you've made that I've seen since then is the enormity and the difficulty of the decision you faced in dealing with the Hillary Clinton investigation in 2016. That said, I want to ask you about two aspects of that decision, one that really goes more to the stagecraft of it and one that goes more to the substance of it. First of all, you decided to make the announcement. I understood the investigation was closed. This is the announcement on July 5th of 2016. As you explain in the book and have explained elsewhere, you were obviously in a difficult situation with respect to the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, who had just appeared publicly with Bill Clinton, and certainly an announcement that said that Hillary Clinton was sort of cleared of charges by Loretta Lynch, pardon me, would have met with some skepticism, undoubtedly from Trump and others. I guess my question to you, though, about the stagecraft of that is why did you make the, why shouldn't someone else at Justice, since the FBI, after all, doesn't make decisions on who to charge with crimes, why shouldn't that have, given that Lynch wasn't suited for it and that your position didn't seem to suit you for it, why wasn't there another option for how to handle that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And thank you for having me here today. I was only kidding about the bad memory of a year ago. But thank you for the
Nobody
opportunity.
Nobody here had anything to do with it.
Yeah. But thanks for the opportunity to have this conversation. It's a really good question, and I'm not certain that I arrived at the right answer. I think I did, but I can also see reasonable people seeing it differently. Here's how I saw it at the time. That the Attorney General was in a position where she could not credibly announce a decision to not prosecute a case against Hillary Clinton. And I faced a number of choices. One, at that moment, I could have said, you know what, we need a special prosecutor to do it. But I thought that would be brutally unfair to the subject of the investigation, who was Hillary Clinton. And I don't mean that as a political statement. Mm-hmm. I mean that as an ethical statement. I just thought, I know there's no case there. And nobody who knows this business would think there's a case. If I call for a special prosecutor right now, I will be doing something really unfair. Not only making this thing continue for many months, but sending a signal to the American people that I know to be false, that there's something there. Another possibility is that I could have gone to the Attorney General and tried to convince her to delegate her authority to some other Justice Department official so they could do the announcement with me, maybe the Deputy Attorney General, who I respected and had known a long time, Sally Yates. But the problem there was the Attorney General had already announced publicly that she would not recuse herself. Without consulting me, she made an announcement and said, but I will accept Jim Comey. She didn't say I'll accept the FBI's recommendation. She said I'll accept Jim Comey's recommendation and that of the career prosecutors. And so I felt at that point like I'm stuck because I can't really go to my boss now and say that was a mistake, what you did. And so I thought, look, the least bad alternative is to make an announcement, but do it separate from them and that will be the thing best calculated to reduce the damage to the institutions of justice and to increase faith and confidence that the result was done in a decent and independent way. And really, it wasn't really the Trumpists that I was so worried about, because there were going to be loud voices on, I don't know, the right and left make sense anymore, but there would be loud voices from that part that would be yelling. But I think that even if Fox News had never been born and there was no internet, there would be keen interest by reasonable, responsible people in what happened to the investigation, criminal investigation, of one of the two candidates for president of the United States during the election year. I think in the 1800s, people would justifiably want to know, so what's the deal? So I thought it was important to have transparency and that the best way to protect the institutions was to do it separate. Mm-hmm. And look, I think that was the right decision, even in hindsight, but look, I think other people, reasonable people, could see it differently.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to a more substantive question about that same announcement. In that same press briefing, you declared that you'd found no clear evidence that Clinton intended to violate the law, but you also added that she and her associates, and I'm quoting now from your announcement, were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. I guess my question to you is, with all due respect, sort of where do you get off pronouncing on something that isn't about the law? I mean, I say this jokingly, but no. I imagine the investigation of Jim Newton for bank robbery, and you come back and say, well, we found no guilt evidence he's guilty of bank robbery, but he's a really sloppy writer. I'd be kind of pissed off. So I guess my question is, why is that something you felt you should pronounce?
That's another really reasonable question. And here's my response. That, first of all, the Department of Justice has long maintained an approach with important exceptions. When we close investigations, we don't say anything.
Usually say nothing, right?
Right. Yeah. Or maybe we'll notify the person who's investigated, it's over. But in cases of important public interest and justifiable public interest, the department has long provided details to explain to the public why you know this was done in the right way. Ferguson, Missouri. After we decided, FBI investigated, the Department of Justice decided that the police officer who killed Michael Brown, there was not an adequate basis for a criminal prosecution. We released an 82-page report that laid out all the evidence in that case. The alleged targeting by the Tea Party, of the Tea Party by the IRS. When the department, another case the FBI investigated, decided there was no there, it still released a very detailed accounting of that investigation and criticized this woman named Lois Lerner, saying she was guilty of poor management, but it wasn't something that rose to the level of a prosecution. So it's always been the exception, but it's an exception that the department has always turned to when there's an important public interest. Again, I could be wrong about this, but my thinking at the time, and still, is that there was an intense and justifiable public interest in understanding the basis for this decision. And I know a lot of people characterize it as me criticizing Hillary Clinton. That's actually not how I thought about it. I thought about it as, I am giving the American people an honest description of what we found. I could have left that out, and there's all kinds of reasons why I wish I hadn't used the term extremely careless. But really, we're also describing, there were 8 conversations about top secret topics, and dozens about secret topics. I'm not sure how much I added by saying, that's really sloppy. That's obviously really sloppy. So one little nit. I wish I had said really sloppy. And part of the reason I thought I had to characterize it is, it would lack credibility otherwise, is how I thought about it. That if I pulled back in characterizing the conduct, it would lack credibility in two respects. First, that I wasn't candid about it, but second, I needed to explain to the American people, look, this isn't the ordinary stuff. The ordinary stuff is somebody leaves a document in a Starbucks and then they go back and get it. But it's also not the stuff that we prosecute people for. It's in the middle. And so the term I chose was extremely careless, which caused a big megillah because that was a term that people then said was in a 1917 statute and I had all this business with Republicans, which all of which was nonsense. I should have said really sloppy. This is sloppy in Starbucks. This is criminal. It's in the middle. It was really sloppy, but it's not the kind of thing that gets prosecuted. And so I felt like I had to characterize it in some fashion to be transparent and to explain the logic of the result. But again, look, thoughtful people, I can hear some of them in this audience exhaling at me, but thoughtful people could see it differently, and I acknowledge that.
Last question on this topic.
Yeah.
I certainly can't blame you for being one of many people who thought Hillary Clinton would win this election. I certainly was one of them, too. But how much did that thought that she was likely to win this election, if at all, influence any decision you made regarding what you said publicly about this investigation?
I don't know that it ever consciously affected me. And someone told me I made a big mistake in this book, Washington Memoirs, people aren't usually introspective and cross-examining themselves. But the question I've asked in the book is, okay, I remember actually intentionally pushing aside polls and stuff like that. And one of the most important questions I was asked during the deliberations was, should you consider that what you're about to do may help elect Donald Trump president in October? And I said no, because if I start considering who will be affected in what way, that's the end of the FBI as an independent force in America. We're just another partisan player at that point. So no. But look, the whole world, I think probably including candidate Trump, was assuming that Hillary Clinton was going to be elected president. And so I'd be a fool to say it couldn't have had an impact on me. But here's the thing, even looking at myself in hindsight, it wouldn't have changed my choices or how I thought about them. It probably would have made the decision, it would have made the weight differently on some of the options, but I don't see a change in the result, even if Donald Trump was up 20 points in the polls. But I caused a lot of confusion by being introspective in the book, but I thought I had to be.
That's probably worth it. Okay, let me move on to a sort of nerdy question here. But a lot of discussion in recent months about the independence of the Department of Justice. I think all of us sort of assume that that's a good thing. The department should be independent and that that's something we value. And yet, history has some mixed examples of that, right? J. Edgar Hoover ran a very independent FBI, and there's much to regret about it. Bobby Kennedy was attorney general to his brother. We wouldn't argue that that was independent. So what do we really mean by the need for independence? And what does that sort of look like on the ground as opposed to in sort of political science terms?
Yeah. It doesn't mean that the FBI should be in, you know, like the Fed, mm-hmm. right? To my mind, it means the FBI should be in the executive branch, subject to the constraint and oversight and checks and balances that are inherent in the three branches of government and in a number of the oversight mechanisms of the executive branch. But so it's in the executive branch for important reasons. You mentioned mm-hmm. a couple of them. But it should never be entirely of the executive branch. And I mean by that in disposition and in practice. In disposition meaning the people of the Department of Justice, prosecutors and agents and analysts, can't be thinking about anything but what are the facts and what's the law. They can't ever be looking towards their political masters. I think it's appropriate that the department is led by a political appointee for mm-hmm. reasons I can explain, but I think the disposition has to be, I want to know the facts and the law. We have to be seen when we knock on a door or when we rise in a courtroom as an other in American life.
And do you mean that specific to the FBI or to the Department of Justice? General?
Department as a whole. Uh-huh. Because you can't, the entire department is designed, in my mind, since Watergate, to embody the blindfold that Lady Justice wears. There's no peeking out to see whether the president is happy or angry with what you're doing. You are trying to find the facts and apply it to the law. And you're human, so you're going to be flawed, but that should be the disposition. In practice, it means the political leadership should have no input on a case. And I try to explain to people that the distinction, not to wax too poetic, but I go to the beach in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And there's between the Barrier Islands in North Carolina, there's spots, one I know in particular, where there's no land, but the water from the ocean is meeting the water from the sound. And the turbulent waters of the ocean, when they hit the sound, actually waves break, even though there's no land there. And I used to explain to people, that's the political meeting the apolitical, and the leadership of the department, the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, stand in that spot of turbulence. And so long as they know there's an inherent conflict between the political and the apolitical, they can find their footing. But the dividing line is a single letter, S. It's totally appropriate for a president to run for office and say, we ought to do more cases of this kind. Environmental enforcement, child support enforcement, guns, opioid. It's never appropriate for the president to drop the S and say, we ought to do this kind of, this case. I want this person prosecuted. I want to know that this person has been put in jail. Because when that S is dropped, and you allow that water from the ocean into the sound, you've polluted the entire thing. Mm-hmm. And so disposition, and in practice, the political has to confine itself to the S plural. It's what's so dangerous today about the President of the United States calling for the investigation and prosecution, not just of me. I mean, I have a personal interest there.
Significant one.
Yeah. Well, but it makes me laugh because there's no, it's,
right, of course,
that's
yeah.
frivolous. But look, it's a dangerous, dangerous erosion of that separation. And it's a place that I'm not sure we've been, certainly in my lifetime. And that risks violating the practical divide and then polluting the disposition that's so important. Donald Trump will at some point not be president of the United States, and so the risk of the next president.
You have a fairly partisan crowd.
The risk of the next president tweeting at all, probably, but the next of the next president tweeting that so-and-so should be in jail or so-and-so should be out is negligible. The danger is that the disposition, the culture of the organization will be eroded, mm-hmm. that we must wear the blindfold at all times. And so that's how I think about it. Now, the good news is that the reason I get up every morning in general, but the reason I'm optimistic is I've led the FBI and I've led the Department of Justice, and I've tried to change its cultures in some ways. I tried to change the FBI's with respect to diversity, for example. And I made progress, but it was incredibly hard. And I focused on it every day for 4 years. There should be solace in that. The culture of the FBI is, there is no deep state, there's a deep culture. In the military services, in the intelligence community, in the law enforcement community, that runs all the way to the bedrock, and it's about the rule of law and the truth. No president serves long enough to screw that up. Even if you set out to work on it every day to change it, when your 8 years is up, even if you served 8 years, the culture will remain. So it's frustrating when you're trying to change the culture at the margins for the reasons that I cared about changing. It's comforting to know that deep culture, it's going to outlast any particular political regime.
Similar related question, again, to the kind of organization and checks and balances we take for granted here, or used to take for granted. There's obviously a role for congressional oversight of FBI, DOJ, CIA, any agency. Historically, that oversight has produced some important revelations. There's also the sense, I think, that many people share, I suspect some people in this room, that congressional oversight today, with respect to the Russia investigation, is being used to thwart the investigation, to inhibit it, or possibly, as we discovered today, even to reveal the identity of an FBI informant. Whether that came out of the congressional process, I realize is still a little murky. But how do we strike the right balance of appropriate oversight without allowing the political interests of those doing that oversight to obstruct and impede the work of law enforcement?
Yeah, that's a question of the day, and I don't have a great answer. It depends upon the quality and character of the people in the oversight roles and their recognition of two things. First, that they are a separate branch of government. In the mind of our founders, actually, although co-equal in name, superior, at least the early days of our republic. And so that the design of our government requires that they be a separate branch of government. And the second thing is that the only sustainable, in the long run, operation of the intelligence community, including the FBI, requires that oversight. Because that oversight, the FBI works and the CIA is able to work and the NSA works because the American people can have confidence that when I don't know something, because we have to have secrets, when I don't know something, there's a machine that works to really represent me as an American citizen, to check these people and to constrain them and to oversee them. And in the long run, their credibility with the American people is the key to their effectiveness. Uh-huh. I mean, I talked about the FBI in particular. If you're not trusted at that doorway or in that courtroom, you're done. And so we have to have people who understand the genius of the design of the founders and why the checking and balancing is so critical to the mission of those organizations. But ultimately, it comes down to the character of the people in the roles. And I agree with your summary of they've in large measure abandoned that role. In fact, not just abandonment, actually might be benign neglect.
Right.
They've actually gone over to acting almost as if they're part of the executive branch.
I mean, when you describe
the House. I don't mean to pick on the Senate. I've actually been impressed with the way the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner and Richard Burr have conducted themselves in a way the founders would have been proud, and we all should be proud.
I mean, there's something jarring about the comparison of the ideal representative, you know, embodying the vision of the founders and understanding the separation of powers, and then Devin Nunes. You know, at the risk of being too partisan here, that's just not the person I'm familiar with.
Right. And I didn't mean to suggest that. You heard me saying that.
I mean, that is the jam. And then as an accountability matter, we, the citizens of LA or other places, don't really have much authority over someone like that because he's elected from a small place. So it does seem like that is out of whack. And I'm not really sure what to do to address that, if there's an intelligent way to bring oversight back within some boundaries, but also preserve the importance of it.
I think it's going to require what I call the sleeping giant, that the American people more broadly to wake up to the threats to our norms and values, and because it's going to take a change in political culture, and that's only going to come at the hands of the American people in a much larger sense. I call it the sleeping giant because I imagine a bell curve, the American people, and the wings are where the nuts are. And in the great middle are the busy people living their lives who are the embodiment of our values, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. They share, I've talked to the kids about it today, they share a set of values. No matter how they feel about the hot button issues of the day, they share those values. They're too busy, distracted, turned off, I think, to realize the threats and how important it is for them to participate and to vote those values. And so I think a change is only going to come with a significant political change, and that's only going to come at the hands of the sleeping giant waking up. And I'm an optimist, and so I've seen over my lifetime, every generation or two, the sleeping giant wakes up. The sleeping giant woke up to images of children being bit by dogs in Birmingham, Alabama. And our country changed in large measure as a result of, this is what Dr. King was writing to from Birmingham jail, the moderates, the sleeping giant must awaken. And I think that's what it's going to take today. And my role, the reason I've written this book, the reason I'm talking about it is to try and be a small part of driving that conversation, to try and awaken the sleeping giant.
I was actually going to ask this later, but that's a good segue, I think, to a question I had for you that I'm sure a lot of people do. I was surprised, frankly, when I first saw you with George Stephanopoulos, when you were asked the question about impeachment, and your response was that you thought the better remedy would be for voters to address this at the next election. Here's the reasons I was surprised. First, I think for a lot of people that feels like a long time to wait. candidly, I mean, second, I realize that impeachment is really fundamentally more of a political process than a legal process, but there's obviously a legal component to it, and it feels like that's what we're building toward. And then third and finally, the sleeping giant, the voters that you speak so eloquently of, they did, after all, as a majority, vote for Hillary Clinton. So it feels to me like there's a mechanical issue to talk about, and in fact, the kids here raised it earlier, with the Electoral College that may be separate from this notion that voters kind of need to take responsibility for what they did last time. Voters elected Hillary Clinton, right? I mean, what they didn't do is the Electoral College didn't elect Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, so I'll come to the Electoral College second. The kids ask great questions about that. But what I meant when I talked about impeachment with George Stephanopoulos is I do think that's a process that should be driven by law, that's set out in our Constitution, and if the facts justify it and the political forces think it's appropriate, then I'm agnostic. What I was trying to express was a sense, in a way, that would let all of us off the hook. And not just let us off the hook, but drive a dysfunction and a divide deep into the fabric of America, leaving, 40%, maybe it's probably less than that, 30% of voters believing there'd been a coup. And I think it's much healthier for our country. We need an inflection point. We need a reset. And that's only going to come, I believe, if the American people, not just those who voted in a majority for Hillary Clinton, but so many of those who didn't vote, get off the couch, get out of the busy car. I know you're carpooling, you got a lot to do. And vote your values in this country. I don't care whether it's for Democrat or Republican, but vote for people who reflect a commitment to the rule of law, equal protection of the laws, and the truth. That will be a moment of clarity and inflection in this country that will not allow the angry wing to say, it was stolen from us. No, it wasn't. The American people stood up and said, no more. And that is the moment of clarity that we need, that impeachment would not only deprive us of, would in some ways postpone for many, many years. And so that's why, as odd as it sounds, I secretly hope we don't have an impeachment and conviction, because we, the sleeping giant, need to speak for this country.
Fair enough. Let me pull a question from the audience here that's a much more direct one. How long do you think Rosenstein will keep his job?
That's a really good question. I don't have a high confidence answer, but and this could be my projecting optimism and hope instead of facts, But I think the special counsel and Rod Rosenstein are going to be allowed to see this thing through to the end. And I think in part because the president has figured out that not only would it be stupid to fire them, it would be stupid for a whole other reason that people don't focus on. I really don't think it would end the investigation.
I'm so glad you said that.
because you'd have to fire everyone. I mean literally everyone in the FBI and the Department of Justice, because someone will pick it up. There are 94 U.S. attorney's offices. New York's already got a piece. Having been an SDN, Southern District of New York prosecutor, they will pick it up. And so you'd have to fire those people and their career people, and they can't really be fired. So it would be stupid on one level and impracticable, that's a made-up word maybe, on the other side. And so I'm starting to believe that for whatever combination of those reasons, that they will see it through to the end.
And what, this is just a techno question, but let's assume the worst. Let's assume the president fired Rosenstein, whoever replaced Rosenstein fired Mueller or whatever, the whole thing came tumbling down. What would happen to the products of the investigation that have already been gathered? They don't just get shredded.
Well, that's what I mean.
Right. That all goes somewhere.
That'd be picked up. Yeah. Some FBI field office would take a piece that fit within them. Their U.S. attorney's office would help them work it. New York would surely grab a big piece of it and run with it. State prosecutors might pick up pieces. It just would be really, really hard to kill it by removing mm-hmm. Rosenstein and convincing someone to remove Mueller. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm actually reasonably optimistic mm-hmm. that it'll be seen through to the end.
A couple other just small questions about the investigation. Do you expect to be interviewed by Mueller as part of this?
I can't comment on that.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't comment. Logically, I'm a witness.
For what it's worth, I would expect you to be.
Yeah, I'm a witness, but I've left anything about the Russia investigation out of the book, and I don't talk about my interactions with special counsel.
This is just a more peckish question then. You've known Rudy Giuliani a long time, followed him in New York.
You said peckish?
Yeah, that's my made-up word, too. How do you regard him as a lawyer, and how well do you think he's serving the president?
Rudy hired me as an AUSA in 1987, and he was U.S. attorney, and I think I was very excited to work for him at the time. I have a different view as an adult of his leadership, but I honestly so. He seems different than when I knew him in 1987. His impression of me is clearly different. I used to be one of his stars. No more, it seems.
Right.
I don't mean this as a facetious answer. I don't know how well he's serving the president because I don't know what their goals are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I could imagine, it would seem odd to me, but I could imagine a set of goals that Rudy's conduct in the public square is serving, that he and the president think is in their interest. So I can't judge it from here.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. This is a total change of subject, but also a question from the audience. On a more personal note, it says, can you share with us your family's response to the election of Donald Trump? You've talked a little bit about your wife and daughters and their response to it. How has the rest of your family dealt with all this?
My wife and kids were very disappointed and very much wanted. My wife's view was interesting, that she considered Secretary Clinton to be a seriously flawed candidate, but very much wanted a woman to be president of the United States, and thought this was the moment, and was really, really important, and so was bitterly disappointed, as were my other children, four of whom are my daughters, about that. Mm-hmm. And they marched the day after the inauguration in the Women's March. So I got that. They were not, thank God, angry at me. But my wife was very angry at the situation. Mm-hmm. And if she were here, she'd say, you know, stop talking about what my husband did and start explaining why you weren't in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania over and over again. Mm-hmm. But she gets very angry, too, that just at circumstances that I was in the situation I was in. Mm-hmm. She would say, look, I get it, but why does it have to be you? Mm-hmm. And so that part has been painful for them. Mm-hmm. But they still love me.
Yeah. I hear that. This is maybe another question you can't answer, but You, as you're well aware, you worked at the behest of the president, subject to being fired. He could fire you because you're tall, right? I mean, he had the unlimited right to fire you.
He has not given that as a reason yet.
He has not so far given it. But, to what degree, though, given that he has essentially unrestricted prerogative to fire you, how does firing you ever get construed as obstruction?
It's a really good question. One, I guess I can answer in a theoretical sense. I don't know whether this is how the special counsel thinks of it. You could construct, in theory, an obstruction case if the firing was done with corrupt intent, so that specific intent to stop an investigation that you knew was pending at the time. Now, it's an interesting question. First of all, it's a question about whether the president could be charged with a crime to begin with.
Right.
It's an interesting question about, given that the president's authority, it's an at-will employment, could it ever be? I think it's a reasonable argument to be made it could be if it was done with the proper intent.
He didn't do a very good job of stopping the investigation.
Yeah, so, yeah. Right. And so look, but I'm also, I think sometimes it's an odd answer when I say I don't know whether President Trump committed obstruction in his conversations with me about Michael Flynn or in the firing, because I don't have visibility into his state of mind. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the evidence is that reflects upon what he was thinking at that moment. And especially with respect to my firing, I've seen, in the early, first of all, it was over the Clinton email investigation, but I never bought that. But then it was about Russia, which seemed to make more sense to me, but I've since heard him say other things.
No, right.
So I can't answer those questions. Mm-hmm. And luckily, as a witness, I don't have to answer those questions.
Right. Is there, and this is really a legal question, so I'm not asking of you as a potential witness, but is there a remedy? Let's imagine that Mueller were to find something that doesn't rise to the level of that Congress believes is an impeachable offense, but is nevertheless potentially a criminal offense. Like he cheated on his taxes. Is in violation of the Emoluments Clause, as has been alleged. Is there any remedy to punish a president other than impeachment and removal? Is there the possibility to fine him? Is that what we're left with? Is this binary question of either impeach and remove him or just let him go?
I'm not expert enough to answer it. I'm not aware of options other than that, maybe with one exception you didn't mention. I've heard it said that you could wait till after a president left office,
and
so long as the
then.
Statute of limitations hadn't run, and charge him then. And I've seen some scholars arguing that you could indict the president, but not proceed against him. You could bring an indictment under seal to toll the statute of limitations and not unseal it until after he left office. And I don't know enough to give you a handicap on whether those pass muster.
Let me ask a few questions, some of which come from the audience and some of which are mine, more general, moving away from the investigation here for a minute. Several members of the audience asked for just your reflections a little bit on the relationship between the FBI and black community. Whether it's mass incarceration or allegations about that, whether the FBI's, as this member of the audience said, explain the FBI's focus on black identity extremists, will the emphasis on black identity extremists when violence perpetrated by white supremacists, why the emphasis on black identity extremists when violence by white supremacist groups seems to be at a high? Just take a minute, if you would, and talk about the FBI and its history.
That's a really important topic. So I'll start with an overall impression of the black community is not a monolith, the FBI is not a monolith, so I'll generalize. I think despite its history, which is a remarkable thing to say, I think the FBI's relationship with the African-American community in every place where the Bureau is, which is in nearly every community, is really, really good. And that's remarkable given the history. And you know this, one of the things I did at the FBI was order that we study that history and that we, every trainee at the FBI, take a curriculum focused on the FBI's use of its authorities to target civil rights leaders, especially Martin Luther King. And that at the close of that curriculum, they, meaning not just agents, but analysts, all travel to Washington and go to the King Memorial, take a quotation off the wall, and write an essay as your final exam in the course, talking about the intersection of that quotation and the values of the FBI. An ambiguous assignment, but intentionally ambiguous, because we don't want to tell them what to think. We want to insist that they think and that they know the history. And it became, and I'm confident that it still is, the most popular training course at the FBI. And I got And I got heat from retirees who, some of it came anonymously, but some to my face, which I appreciated the directness, saying, why are you attacking this organization that you lead? And I would explain, I love this organization that I lead. And I love it enough to stare at its history and to own that history so that we never repeat it. And second, I want to attract more, to come to the reason I was here a year ago and got fired that day, I want to attract more people of color to this organization to make it more effective. And I can't do that without being honest with them about the history of this organization and telling them what we're doing about it. And so at the top level, I'm very proud of the way we stared at ourselves and the progress that had been made. And I think, especially in the wake of Ferguson and obviously on a series of other terrible incidents involving the death of black men in law enforcement custody and encounters with law enforcement, the FBI played an indispensable role. I'm very proud of that. I don't like to brag, but I went and gave a speech at Georgetown University called The Hard Truths, where I said, these are the things that are true about law enforcement in the United States. And the first thing I said is, we have long been the enforcer of a status quo that was brutal to people of color, especially black people, and we must own that because the people we're supposed to serve and protect of color can't ever forget it. And then I talked about implicit bias. And then I ordered every FBI office, and as you know, we're in every state, every part of this country, to use our convening authority to bring together communities, especially the black community, and bring law enforcement, uniform law enforcement, and use, we don't do policing in the FBI, but we're everywhere and people respect us. Bring them together, because it's hard to hate up close. Let's get close to each other and talk about where are we in this community and how do we get better. And we did that multiple times, rounds of it all around the country. And we didn't change the world, but we made a contribution. I still think, and one of the stories I tell in the book is why I talked about what I saw happening in the black community and relationship with law enforcement and my worry that it was contributing to increase in the deaths of young black men. And I still believe that we saw a significant spike at the end of 2014 that's starting to drop off now in cities all around the country because the lines of law enforcement and the black community were arcing away from each other. And I had a great conversation with President Obama about this. And I think we had a role to play there, and we did a reasonable job of playing in it. Now, to come to the second question, one of the FBI's jobs is to protect people from acts of violence, especially terrorism. International terrorism is one half of our counterterrorism division. Domestic terrorism is the other half. The domestic terrorism division of the FBI is dominated by our work focusing on militia groups, KKK groups, white supremacists, all kinds of dangerous and potentially violent groups that are oriented around their white identity. At the same time, in the United States, there are people who are organized around a totally distorted view of their black identity and other racial identities, their black identity, believing they need to commit acts of violence in the name of that black identity to serve some higher purpose. You ought to be fired and you're in the FBI. If you don't, when you develop facts about that, investigate that. The black identity extremist thing was that label, I guess, was developed after I left, but I think I can understand what it was, an effort by intelligence analysts to explain, to figure out a name for those people who, by virtue of a distorted view of their black race, their African-American heritage, believe they need to engage in acts of violence. And so I really don't see it as fairly criticized as a targeting of the black community. It's an effort to figure out what are these people who, by their literature and by their actions, are bent on acts of violence, and we had one of them kill five police officers in Dallas in the name of a black identity group called the Moorish Nation. And so to my mind, this is an effort to understand this and save lives by stopping it. Here's the good news. It's a pain in the butt for the FBI to investigate groups of any kind, especially groups based on identity, racial identity, religion, things like that. And it's an enormous pain in the butt to be able to conduct electronic surveillance of such groups. That's a wonderful thing. You know this, but I kept under my glass. I had this big desk at FBI headquarters that every director had used since Hoover. His was put in a museum someplace or something. But it had a glass top on it so I wouldn't screw it up. And I kept under the right-hand corner of it a single sheet of paper which was a copy of a document from October of 1963. And it's a single-page memo from J. Edgar Hoover to Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy was the Attorney General, Hoover was the FBI Director. And it's to request authority to bug and wiretap Martin Luther King. And it's five sentences long. And it doesn't have any factual substance. It just says, there's a communist influence in the racial situation. That's a quote. And so we need to bug this guy. No time limitation, no date limitation, no oversight whatsoever. Hoover signs it. My copy has Kennedy's signature on it. And they're off to the races. And I kept that there because that was the corner of my desk where every morning I would put the stack of requests that we were making in our national security cases for wiretaps. And those requests are this thick or this thick. And I explained to the organization, because everybody gossips about the director and they heard that I had this piece of paper, and I said, it's there because the stack reflects constraint and oversight. I don't keep the piece of paper there to pick on Bobby Kennedy, to pick on Hoover. I have no doubt they believed they were doing the right thing. And there is the danger. There was nobody to check them and to oversee them and say, what do you mean there's a communist influence in the racial situation? And why does that justify doing this to King? That stack represents oversight, and it's there as a reminder, yes, it's a pain in the butt. Good. It should be a pain in the butt. And so that's a long answer, but I hope it gives you a flavor of how we thought about these things. Always flawed, because we're a human organization, but I'm very proud of the way we oversaw and constrained and deployed those authorities.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, one of the tools used by the Bush administration and the Obama administration to try to improve community relations with minority communities was the imposition of police monitors and consent decrees. Certainly, the experience in Los Angeles is widely regarded as a very successful one in that respect. This administration seems disinclined to go forward with those. Do you think that's a mistake?
Big mistake, yeah. I mean, I don't have to give you a long explanation. Look, it's painful and it's difficult for communities, and LA is an example. There was a lot of pain, but you emerge, in some ways, I'm sure a lot of people here have children. One of the most effective techniques I have found for raising our kids is for me to be the bad guy. So that you can say to that boy who on a date in high school wants you to smoke a joint or wants to demonstrate his affection for you in inappropriate ways. You can say, well, I'd like to do it, but my father's a maniac.
And my father, right. And my father's the head of the FBI.
Right. Right. And so,
right. That'd spook him.
But so I used to say to the kids, let me be your excuse.
Uh-huh.
Where the federal government has been so valuable to police departments around the country is, they've been the excuse for mayors and police chiefs and rank and file and union leadership. And they throw things at the feds, say, those bastards, blah, blah, blah. But they all know that they're helping us get to a better place, get to be a more effective police department. So it's an enormous mistake to walk away from that.
Mm-hmm. Setting aside the particulars of this president, what's your assessment of the state of the quality of intelligence in this country today compared to September 11th?
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel that we are a substantially safer country today than we were then?
Yes. We have, today in the United States, the intelligence community that you thought you had before 9/11. that we are, and it's not we anymore, the intelligence community is knit together, shares information, different spheres of responsibility, but is knit together in ways that would be unimaginable to somebody who went to sleep before 9/11. An example, the number two person in the FBI's National Security Branch sat at my table every morning. My most senior staff meeting was a CIA case officer, one of their senior executives. They joked it was their best penetration ever of the FBI. But that's a symbol that reflects a reality. Because now, to get promoted in any of the intelligence community agencies, which include the FBI, you had to do joint duty assignment. And that human knitting together is genius, and really the only way to change relationships. Because you can think all those FBI people are, you know, knuckle-dragging idiots, except her, who I work with, and him, who I work with. If there's enough of that, you knit together. One. Two, our systems are so much better, and we share dots so much more effectively than we did before. If we have a challenge today, or we did when I left, we shared so much information with each other that we were having data management problems. But the intelligence community of the United States is on its way to building a single classified cloud so that all of its data is placed in a single cloud. We're actually more secure by that because we can tag the data and tag the people. And knowing that an analyst who has authority to investigate a particular Al-Qaeda threat, all the dots will be in this cloud. And so there's no risk that you'll miss something if you have the right software to search through it. Those kinds of things are the way we'll get safer. But even without that, it's a night and day compared to before 9/11.
Should that make us nervous at all? I mean, that sounds, I mean, there are privacy implications to that, or just, I mean, there are clearly security implications, but should it make us personally
Insecure? Well, I don't think so, because it actually offers you cleaner audit opportunities, because if we have the same systems, same processes, same software, same clearance mechanisms, we can keep track of who saw whose data, who touched it. It's much, and what contractors touched it. The problem we have today is there's there's hundreds of systems and different standards and different levels of access, and you don't know what a contractor's seeing as against an experienced officer. The audit capabilities aren't nearly as good. The problems that the NSA had in trying to figure out what Snowden had seen, for example, were incredible. And so I actually think it protects the intelligence community better from an insider threat perspective, and it offers higher assurance on the civil liberties front because we can tell who did what with what. Mm-hmm. And you all know this, but I'll state the obvious. What the government has is a pimple compared to what the private sector knows about everybody in this auditorium. Mm-hmm. And people always, and I think it's really important to focus on the government's authorities, but it's we used to, if we could only be Facebook, right? but which is this whole separate thing that we as a culture have to grapple with. But I actually think that's a positive development, the idea of an IC cloud for both security and liberty.
You were reading back on clips when the Patriot Act was being debated, and you were really one of the few people that I came across who supported the act, but supported it really without what appeared to be much political. I mean, a lot of people supported it because Bush supported it and opposed it because Bush supported it. Reflect on that. Do you remain convinced that it's important for the security of the country? I mean, it's sort of a bit of an oversimplification to call it an act, really, right? Because it's a million statutes. But on balance, has it served the country well? And do we still need it?
Yeah. It got bumper stickered by both proponents and opponents.
Agreed.
Proponents would say, we're all going to die if the Patriot Act's not reviewed. And opponents would say, we're all going to die because it's there. Mm-hmm. It was a very complicated, as you said, piece of legislation that contained all kinds of fixes that everyone, if they knew the details, would focus on. And for example, one was to give a judge authority that if there's a terrorist who keeps switching cell phones, that the judge could issue in his order, you don't have to come back to me each time and get a new order for the new cell phone. You can stay up on the new cell phone and come to me while you're, these are simple things, but they protect us. And so in the main, I think it was I didn't think it was essential, which is why the Republicans didn't think I was all that great an advocate for it. I thought it was useful and sensible, and still do.
Is there anything you'd change about it, any particulars that you would change in it, either to address privacy concerns or to enhance security capability?
I never thought, we had this big debate a few years ago about Section 215, which was the authority of the NSA to collect telephone dialing information in the United States. And even at the time, I didn't think that was all that important a tool. And I thought it was oversold in private to Congress. And I thought that once Snowden made it private, it was oversold publicly. Mm-hmm. And so I would have, if I were the intelligence, and I came in after that debate, and one of the first things I said to President Obama is, this thing's not as important as they may be telling you it is. And so I worry that the intelligence community spent credibility on that particular thing that wasn't worth spending. It wasn't all that important. And freaked a lot of people out for not great reason.
Uh-huh. We have a hard stop at 9, so I want to leave opportunity for you to answer more reflectively on a couple of questions. And unfortunately, one of these students stole my question earlier, but these people didn't hear it, so it's okay. You've worked obviously closely and cooperatively with two presidents, Bush and Obama, more briefly, less cooperatively maybe with a third. Could you take just a minute and just reflect on your sense of the three of them as people and what distinguished, what they have in common and what distinguishes them from each other?
Yeah. I don't tweet a lot, but I tweeted not long ago that that in my book I use talk about two presidents as examples of some of our values, and then I have a counterpoint. And someone sent me a tweet by J.K. Rowling, like half the people in the world follow her, and she said, "I love the way he teases. I wonder who the counterpoint is." So the way I would compare them is, I see them as two in one, obviously. Presidents Obama and Bush were very different people and very different approaches to policy and very different personalities. But in my experience, and I saw them both up close, they shared a commitment to a set of values, traditions, and norms that you would want them to share a commitment to. They were both very focused on the dignity of the office and there's the sense that I represent the entire place. That even though I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I have to speak to the entire country. And then I also saw them, because I was involved in very difficult situations with them, caring about the institutional values and getting it right. And what is the law? And what's the Justice Department's best view of this? And tremendous involvement by White House counsel, for example. And so I saw that on the one hand. Mm-hmm. Less, and obviously that's what I mean by the counterpoint. I didn't see it on the current president. But on a personal level, I was really struck that both Bush and Obama appeared to understand the danger of their positions. I was explaining to the kids earlier, every leader sits at the top of a hill, but the president of the United States sits at the top of Everest. And everybody is straight down a sheer face from that president. And if the president's going to make sound decisions, the president has to figure out, how do I get people to talk to me up the hill and tell me the truth? And so I watched both Bush and Obama try to flatten the slope. And one of the ways I explained to the kids was just where we met with them. They would hold all the meetings in the Oval Office in the sitting area, where president, they would sit in the same chair, by tradition, the one with their back to the fireplace, closest to the grandfather clock, and they'd both sit, and they'd invite us to sit, no matter what it was about, on the couches and some armchairs. So you could almost pretend it was a group of friends gathered together. I mean, you never forgot where you were, but it was, it flattened a little bit. And the contrast is, three times, I think, in the Oval Office with President Trump, always behind the desk. The resolute desk sits between him and those trying to speak to him, and that actually makes the slope higher, steeper. And then I saw something else from Bush and Obama. They both used humor to try to flatten the slope. They both would try to lighten the mood, disarm, charm in some ways, but make you relax. Mm-hmm. And Bush's humor, if I had to contrast him a little bit to Obama, sometimes had an edge to it that reflected an insecurity, in my view. Not disabling, but different. Obama's was much more generous and confident. But both of them served to flatten it. And I say this in the book. I've never personally experienced President Trump laughing. And that sounds like a funny thing. That's a really concerning thing.
I'm not laughing because it's
funny.
Yeah,
I know. but I've never, and I've tried to find examples of laughter, and I found one. On YouTube search, I found a mean laugh when a dog was barking at a campaign rally, and he said, "What's that?" And someone said, "It's Hillary." And he went kind of like, "Ha, ha." But it could be I'm overinterpreting this. I mean that. And, you know, I joke, maybe there's some, he keeps people in stitches at other times. But I actually think it reflects a deep insecurity, because it takes confidence to engage in humor with your underlings. Because to laugh is to look a little silly. To laugh at your joke is to acknowledge you said something I didn't say. And that's funny, and you just made me laugh. And I saw Obama and Bush do it very, very well. I've actually never seen President Trump do it, which again keeps the hill very, very steep to him. And that's dangerous because it's hard as a leader to get people to tell you the truth, especially about yourself or about a hard decision. And you're making the hardest decisions in the world. You have to flatten the hill. And I saw both of those first two presidents, Obama and Bush, do it in an effective way. And I'm very concerned. I was there for 5 months, but I had a pretty good view of the way in which the current president does it.
Question from the audience. My name is Eric Johnson, 18 years old, and just finished Glendora High School today. Congratulations.
In Washington and in Houston, to hundreds of MBAs, lawyers, and engineers of color to explain why they should take huge cuts in pay and absorb enormous stress and come to the FBI. And it was working because people want to do work that means something. And I was here that day that I was fired to meet with 700 of those talented people. And I almost kept the appointment after I was fired because I was so passionate about it and I thought it would be a media circus. But it works because, and no one leaves the FBI. I don't care whether you're black or white, Latino, Asian, male, female, gay, straight. You become a special agent of the FBI, the turnover is 0.5% every year.
That's astonishing.
No one leaves. And it's not because of the dough. Right? No one leaves because the mission, you asked me what I missed earlier privately. Mm-hmm. I miss those people who've chosen that mission. It's unbelievably hard. They literally risk their lives for us. That makes you rich beyond your imagination. And once you taste it, it's so hard to go back. And so what I'd urge that young person to do is, don't let the ickiness that you see in our public square today, it's what I said to the kids, do not let that cause you to withdraw. It should cause you to step into it because we need you to pursue that work. And the worst thing you could do is say, nah, and step away from it, then we will be sorry. We'll be sorry a generation from now.
Last question. I'll let you get on with your ride. You're off to Kansas City tomorrow.
Yep.
Good luck. I recommend barbecue.
Everything's up to date in Kansas City.
Very good. Explain the title of your book.
It's obviously a play on the dinner I had with President Trump where he wanted my personal loyalty, but it's actually, I hope, to those people who read it, more significant than that. It's to try and convey the sense that the best leaders I've ever worked for and learned from a lot and made me want to try and be that kind of leader were people who were able to always look above the urgent and the angry and the political and the financial to the things that are above that. When they're making the hardest decisions, they ask, so what are the values of this institution? What's the Constitution? What's the law? What's the long run? What are the external sources of meaning and reference that should help me guide this decision? And they're able to, by that focus, by being above the loyalty to a person or a tribe, by focusing on those things, make better decisions. And I'm particularly concerned today that we are so focused on the fights we have at this level, about guns or immigration or taxes, all really important things, that we are losing sight of the danger to this set of things that unites us. That should be the only thing we are truly loyal to, which is the rule of law, equal protection of the laws, freedom of expression, freedom of religion. The truth is the touchstone of this country, and that we must insist that our leaders reflect a loyalty to that. And then we can get back to fighting about all the other things we fight about, but all we are as a country, I was trying to explain to the kids, something you all know, all we are as a country is a collection of ideas, a collection of values. We're an aspiration, we're imperfect, but it's the most remarkable set of values we seek to pursue. If we lose them, what are we? What are we? And so it's a question I ask I used to be a Republican. I ask my fellow former Republicans, what will you tell your grandchildren? What will you tell your grandchildren you traded for this? I traded the touchstone of truth. I traded the rule of law for what? For a tax cut? For a Supreme Court justice? Only a fool would make that bargain. And so the part I hope to contribute to that conversation is to tell people, this is the only loyalty that matters. And we must hold our current leadership accountable to that. and then insist that the people who follow, no matter what, I don't care what party they are, but that they reflect that loyalty. And so that's what I mean by our loyalty. It's really all we are as a country, and it's going to be our saving grace.
All right. I want to thank all of you for being here aloud for this wonderful series, and especially you for your visit. I hope we've erased the memories of your last time here in Los Angeles, and wish you all the best.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. Great. Thank you.
This Aloud program was supported in part thanks to a generous gift from Jeffrey and Cecilia Glassman. Annual support for Aloud is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support is provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation donors. Media support is provided by KCRW 89.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.